And good morning and welcome to a Red River Radio Spotlight. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio, and opening up tonight at the Shreveport Little Theater, it's a new production of Steinbeck's classic of Mice and Men. And joining me now in our Knoll Foundation studio is Blaine Weaver, who is going to be featured as George in this production. And on his way from the ether is Logan Slick. He'll be popping in,
supposedly.
He's running a little bit behind this morning. So, Blaine, thanks for joining me this morning. And Logan, hey,
thank you
how
so
are
much
you
for having
there?
Me.
So, of Mice and Men, this is one of those classic books. It's also one of those books that, ironically, has made the Library Association's most challenging book list because of some of the language. It's set in the Depression era. And it's set in a time when, you know, let's just say sensibilities were different in America.
It was definitely a different time, you know, and like Steinbeck is one of those great American authors who challenged things and you know, talked about things that weren't really talked about a lot. And, you know, in this this play, it's the language of working people.
Right.
You know, there's aspects of race. There's aspects of sexism. There's, you know, all these things that just feel very real. And I think that's why the book has lasted the way it has. It's like it just feels so true.
Absolutely. And it is. It's true to the era. It's true to the times. And it's true to the conditions. This was during an extremely poverty-stricken time in our country, obviously, the Great Depression. Most of us in our generation have no concept of the deprivation that was going on that time, unless you happen to grow up with Depression-era parents.
Right.
Which I did. So, you know, I can almost relate, but I really can't because I never experienced that deprivation. One of the things that fascinated me is that Steinbeck actually did work out on those farms in the early 1900s. And so,
yeah, well, Logan had done some research on it, actually, and there's an interview where Steinbeck talks about that he knew a guy like Lenny and George. These are based on real people, and that the guy, Lenny, ended up going to jail for hurting the boss. The boss, like, had a problem with George, and Lenny hurt the boss. So, obviously, that's different in the narrative, but he's like, this is a real guy. Like, people all would challenge it and say, yeah, you know, this seems a little silly. He's like, no, this is real.
Right.
And I think that's part of, you know, Steinbeck's voice.
And that's part of what he brings to his writing, both The Grapes of Wrath and this. And, you know, so many other of his works that really depict sort of the grit and grittiness of everyday life for millions of Americans.
And I tell you something that's great for me. I'm an English lit major. That's, you know, what I studied in college. I'm a voracious reader. And I loved this book. And I'd never seen the play. I've seen a couple of the movies. And I read the play. And it is directly the book. The play itself is written by Steinbeck. It's
right.
Basically the book without the descriptions. And it just flows so well. And I feel like this is one of those stories that you can see 100 times and see 100 different productions or whatever and still get what you want out of it, like Hamlet or you know any of those classic plays. It's like it's about the journey. And I'm really excited about tonight and getting to do it for a new group of people.
And I'm drawing a blank. I think the original movie that I saw was with Burgess Meredith as George.
Yeah, that sounds right, yeah.
And then I saw one with Robert Blake as George, mm-hmm. and I forget who played Lenny in that one. The Lenny character is one of those lovable yet dangerous characters. He's so simple-minded, but at the same time, he comes across and you know that there's something under there that's a little bit on the scary
side. And as an actor, it's one of those parts of like it seems simple. It seems like an easy job to do, but it's incredibly difficult to have a balance of realism without being cartoony or you know, without being weirdly offensive and, you know, doing a strange crass imitation. You know, to find that truth is very, very difficult. And our Lenny's doing a great job. Jason Sudeikis is so talented, and I'm just really lucky to get to act opposite him because he's got a lot of the heavy lifting. I talk a lot, But his performance is really something.
One of the things that I, doing my research on this, Steinbeck wrote in a journal in 1938, in every bit of honest writing in the world, there is a base theme. Try to understand men. If you understand each other, you will be kind to each other. Knowing a man will never lead to hate and nearly always leads to love. And that's one of the things that you, at least I find in his writing. And some of the characters are, you know, they can be off-putting, you mm-hmm. know, and yet as you learn their heart, as you go through the dialogue and you learn what's underneath all of that gruffness and grittiness and almost, you know, roughness about them, you realize what's going on inside them. And that's one of the things that Steinbeck always was able to do for me was to bring me closer to his characters.
Well, and I'll tell you, it's very much like the portrayal of Lenny. The way he writes, it seems so easy because it's very, you know, almost Hemingway-esque in its, you know, simplicity. But, like, you know, looking at these characters, I write myself, and I look at the ancillary characters and how fleshed out all of them are. Right. And, like, you know exactly who this guy is from, you know, these very simple sentences, and there's no big explanation. It's just they are who they are, and you see that talent in writing, and you're like, wow, that guy's good.
Yeah, you don't need narrative to explain them because they explain themselves through their own dialogue.
Exactly.
So, well, let's for those not familiar with the play, let's go through the plot a little bit, and then we'll get into each of the characters and talk a little bit about them. So give us the layout of the plot.
Sure. Well, George, who I play, and his buddy Lenny, they travel together. They're basically migrant workers moving from job to job where they get paid about $1 a day, and that's how they live. And at the beginning of the play, they're on their way to a ranch job, and they've just left another town where there's a bit of a dust-up because Lenny, in a very innocent way, scared a girl. Mm-hmm. So they had to run out of the city, and now they're going to another place. And it's just about, you know, them getting into this new ranch, and they've got this plan that if they keep working and they keep saving their money, one of these days they're going to have a ranch of their own. And so that's the dream. That's the best laid plans of mice and men. Right. And that's what they're doing. But it's about this friendship. This George is a stern older brother kind of figure who's kind of taken on Lenny as his ward. And Lenny's just this lovable galoot who would do anything for George, but doesn't really understand the ways of the world.
Yeah, he's almost childlike in his mannerisms and his perspectives. So, and yet at the same time, he can have that dangerous element to him because he's a huge guy, you know?
Yeah.
And he's big and he's strong and he's not that bright and he's not that tuned in.
There's a line in the play where he's just like a kid and there ain't no more harm in him than a kid either, except for he's so strong.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And that's really the fearsome part of him. So let's talk a little bit about George. What's his background? Where does he come from? And how does he end up being a migrant worker?
Well, George doesn't have anybody. You know, that's one of the common threads that he talks about a lot. He doesn't have no family. He doesn't, you know, have many friends. And he met Lenny when they were in school together. And at first he used to play a lot of jokes on him and, you know, tease him. And then an incident happened that made him regret that. And he's taken on the responsibility of Lenny. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he even knows that he loves this guy and needs him in his life. But yeah, George is the smartest of the guys who do this job, so he's not too damn smart.
And Logan Sledge has finally arrived here. So Logan, we're into the characters. We're gonna have you describe Lenny for us.
Okay, great.
Tell us about who Lenny is.
Well, Lenny is we've kind of been going. I talked to Jason Shadiskus, the actor who's playing Lenny, early on about being specific about what it is that he is playing, because it's ambiguous somewhat in the script as far as what happened to him, and what his condition is, if you will. There's a moment in the play where George jokes that, you know, he got kicked in the head by a horse when he was little, and then Lenny says that didn't happen, did it? You know, so it was getting with Jason early about kind of what it is that you're going for there, so that at least you know. But he's a gentle giant in many ways. Mm-hmm. There's so many references in the script to him being like a big baby, like a big kid. So that's an element that we've really explored, is just his childlike nature. He's obviously, he's like a loyal dog in many ways to George. You know, George is his whole world. And even when an extreme act occurs in the play, his first thought is George is going to be mad.
Right.
You know, it's not even about the act itself. It's how it's going to impact his relationship with George.
Right.
So it's been really interesting to explore.
In a lot of ways, he's like a pit bull or you know, another guard dog.
He's that loyal German shepherd that just, you know, when you've got that dog that you come home to and they just look at you and it's like, you're everything.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
and that's kind of the way the dynamic is.
Well, now let's go to some of the other characters. Candy, tell us about Candy.
Yeah, Candy's, Richard Fulmer's playing Candy. And Candy is has been on the ranch probably the longest of all the guys. It's really, there's a parallel that's happening between Candy and the Crooks character. Crooks, who's the stable hand or the stable buck. And it's not specific who's been on there longer, but Candy's definitely a lifer and lost his right hand while he was on the ranch. One of the most beautiful speeches in the play for me is Candy's speech about, you know, you've seen what they've done to my dog. Nobody's going to do that for me. I wish they would. I wish somebody would just put me down when it's my time, but they won't. They'll put me on a county, and what do I have? I have no life after that. It's because this whole dream that George and Lenny have crafted for themselves, right, that starts to infect all of the other people on the ranch and in this world. And Candy gets hooked early on.
And Candy also, I think, represents what will happen if they don't get their dream, if they don't get out of this.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Candy is what happens to all of us. And it's, again, it's just speaking of Steinbeck and how talented he is, like, you have Candy, you also have Young Wit, who's the young version.
Oh, yeah.
You have all different versions of this lifespan of this worker who just moves from job to job. They work for a week, they get their 50 bucks, they go to town, they blow their 50 bucks, they come back to work, you know?
Yeah.
It's just as hand-to-mouth to existence.
Exactly.
And no... You know, tomorrow is not thought of as much as, you know, how am I going to get through today?
Well,
exactly.
It's even like you brought up Wit, and Wit and I in discussion afterwards, Carter Callahan's playing Wit. He was asking about this whole scene that he's got where he's talking about Susie's place, which is a cat house that they all go to. And, you know, I thought it was so interesting because he keeps talking about those chairs. You know, and she's got these nice chairs, and finally we landed on, he says, a guy could sit there like he lived there. And I was like, that's what it's about. It's all about finding a home or a place that feels like home. And none of these guys, you know, I was listening as I was racing over here. You know, you're talking about how they're all migrant workers, and they're homeless.
Yeah,
they've got no place like that. They've got no room to their own, as the script says so often. And even a cat house feels like home to one of the characters, to the younger character.
And all of the other workers are blown away that two guys would travel together.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very lonely existence.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think George even realizes how important this connection is to him. It's this friendship is so exciting and so great to play, and there's so many great performances in the show. I'm sure we'll talk about that, but like, just getting to play opposite Jason for this, you know, epic story and arc of a friendship is something really special, I think.
Well, and loneliness and powerlessness and dreams, those are sort of the three key themes in this. And everybody's lonely in this play.
Everybody is,
but it also brings out that sense that you can be in a crowd and still feel isolated, that sense of loneliness that most people can identify at some time in their life, you know, where you're in a group of people, but you feel like the outlier or maybe somebody who doesn't belong, or you don't have any real deep connection to the people. And that's something that I think audiences can identify with. And, you know, the idea of security to these folks is non-existent. They have no secure existence. You know, we're in the modern age. We're all security-minded. You know, are you planning for your 401k? What about your retirement? Do you have your insurance in place? You know, is your home insured? Is your car insured? What is your security plan? In the Depression, the security plan was, can I get enough food to eat today?
Right.
And so it seems that is a pressure on its own that really you know, breaks down all of these characters over time.
Well, it is an existing pressure for many people today.
Oh yeah, even today.
So, but I totally see what you're saying. I mean, there's a moment in the script where you know, Slim and George are having this conversation, and just going back to your idea that even in the midst of all these people, there's that loneliness.
Right.
And Slim looks over at George and says, you know, you get a bunch of guys, you know, in a room together, you know, they better mind their own business. You know, he says the about the only thing a guy's got is that's private is where he's going and where he's been.
Right.
You know, that kind of makes me think back to your comment there.
Yeah, it's kind of a solitary existence. Even, you know, it's walking alone through the crowd. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like being in the middle of New York City and feeling like you're totally isolated from you know, 10 million other people, which is a feeling, you know, people experience all over the world. You know, that sense of isolation and powerlessness. They you know, they don't know whether next week they're going to be working or not, and they're totally like feathers on the wind.
A lot of their plan, a lot of their hopes and dreams are to have a voice, you know, to be able to tell somebody to get out if they don't like them, you know, or to not have to ask permission to go to a circus or a baseball game.
Right.
It's almost like a prison life, and part of the dream that when we finally get that little place, we're going to be the boss of it, and nobody can can us.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that security, that sense of I exist on my own, and I don't have to rely upon the rest of the world to take care of me, in a sense, because I'm taking care of myself. But in the Depression, nobody was taking care of themselves, or at least 25% of the country wasn't. I mean, that's what the unemployment rate was back then. Well, let's go through some of the other characters. How about the boss?
Yeah, the boss is... we've kind of taken this idea that the boss is really kind of secluded from the day-to-day grind of the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of is up in the ivory tower idea. I think we've kind of followed through with that with characterization and costuming and other things. He's running that place. It's a larger land company.
Right.
So he's a cog in the wheel, and we understand that. But he's also in that place. You know, he's at the top of the food chain.
Right.
And the boss is something, you know, obviously these guys are always wary of, but this particular boss is problematic because his son, Curly, is a real hothead and keeps stirring the pot. So the boss becomes a little bit more ominous because he's got an ear in the bunkhouse with Curly.
Yeah, and so if they're talking down on the boss, then it's going to get back to the boss, and that could mean they don't eat the next day. So it puts a pressure on you not to gripe too much.
Yeah, or even if there's any conflict, obviously, then with Curly, then that goes back, because Curly's an extension of the boss, and, you know, if you mess with him, then you're messing with the boss, and you're done, you know.
There's this interesting thing we were talking about with the Curly character, who's kind of like, in fiction, kind of like this iconic jerk.
You know?
He's a smaller guy, and he's angry all the time, and he's always trying to pick a fight. And what's interesting is that he's very similar to George in many ways. And like, there's also this idea that could be George if he was alone. Like,
right.
There are all these lines about, like, I've seen guys who go off alone on the ranches, and that ain't no good. After a while, they get mean.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just think it's an interesting two sides of the same coin kind of thing.
Well, he has a little Napoleon complex there.
Yeah.
He doesn't like big guys, so he definitely is not fond of Lenny.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
You know, who comes across as this daunting, huge character, and he picks on him.
I will say this, though, just to sort of pay tribute to the depth of the script, and... I do think it's one of these bottomless pits. You could keep on digging and exploring.
Right.
There is a moment in the show where we even see Curly, right? This guy who we all hate by this point, you know. We see him kind of raw and vulnerable, and it's interesting. Because I don't think there is a single one-dimensional character in this show.
Well, that goes back to this quote I started out with about trying to understand men is to find a way to love them. You know, once you get to know them and their vulnerabilities and what drives them, then you start to have that empathy and you can kind of relate and understand who they are. Now, Curly's wife, give us a lowdown on her.
Curly's wife, she's been there a couple of weeks, so she's relatively new to the ranch, and she's struggling. She's struggling with loneliness. She's got no one to talk to. There aren't any other women around. She's perceived by the others, obviously, as this, you know, kind of promiscuous tramp person who's just causing trouble, and they want her out of there. But obviously, all of that is just this kind of repressed, sexuality that the guys are obviously experiencing because there aren't any other women around. Right. So, you know, she's driving them crazy. I love Brittany's performance because she's found a real inner strength to the character that she brings out. So while, you know, on the facade, on the outside, there is this flirtatiousness that she's kind of, you know, playing with, we really see inside of that woman, and we see what she's going through and what she's struggling with this relationship that she's not really happy with her own dreams of, this childhood that she had and these dreams of just getting away, going to Hollywood, you know, I mean,
she wanted to be an actress and have the fame and the glamour and all of that. And she's a ranch hand's wife, So obviously, dashed dreams is a theme within her.
Dashed
her
dreams
psyche.
is a theme throughout. I'm afraid.
Yeah, exactly. So, let's go on. The dog. I want to know about the dog.
Oh well, this is an interesting, kind of, I guess, fun fact about our play is the character that's playing Carlson, the actor's Alan Barry. Mm-hmm. And I worked with Alan at Centenary, and he brought his dog in, Ziggy, to play Candy's dog. If you know the script, I don't want to give too much away here, but I mean, so it's funny because Alan's now leading his dog out, you know, so if you have that inner knowledge, it's like, there's a little play within a play happening there.
Right. Okay. So
Ziggy's a very good actor, just for the record.
Oh, okay. Man.
He does exactly what we ask him to do every single time.
Yep. He's great. We're all waiting for an accident, you know, we all told Whit, you know, because Whit's kind of the young punk on the ranch, and he sort of gets all these, you know, details that no one wants. We said, it's you, buddy. You know, if anything happens, you're on cleanup crew.
Well, you know, got to stay in character.
That's it.
You have to stay in character.
Commit to it.
Well, this, I had mentioned this. This has been one of those books that's remained on the 21st century challenged books. And it's mostly because I think, you know, there's coarse language in it, but sometimes people misunderstand. It's there for a reason. It's there to give that realism to the time and to bring that out. So I don't think folks should be afraid of that, you know. A lot of librarians have been challenged by this book,
absolutely.
You know, and a lot of teachers, too.
Yeah, To Kill a Mockingbird.
And, you know, we can argue about that all day long, you know. But To Kill a Mockingbird, perfect example. I mean, nothing in this book is just tossed away. Either it's there for the reality's purpose, or it's there for a thematic purpose. And, like, you know, I think the racism that's dealt with casually is also dealt with in a very beautiful literary way that I love. And I think what we've done in our performance, what Logan and Brittany have done with the kind of sexism that's runs through, has a really nice theatrical resolution, I guess, is the way to say it.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you take some of the racist elements, it's most a lot of this, as in terms of language, anyways, occurs really in that first scene where Candy's introducing you to the ranch and telling you how everything goes and talks about the Crook's character. And if you notice, you know, obviously structurally in the play, then that language isn't used anymore. Especially not after we have the scene with Crooks, where so much about his story and existence is explained. There's that, obviously, but then there's also just how do you approach, I mean, because that's a big question when you're doing a play like this. Right. Are you going to change those words? And I've been an actor in plays where I think when we did Little Foxes, we had to change language, or we didn't have to, but the decision was to change language.
Right.
It told the cast early on, I'm very hands off when it comes to a script. I mean, for me, that's the script. Those are the words. We're going to honor them. And and people can perceive it how they perceive it.
The historian in me says that reality is reality no matter what era or time. So you don't doctor a photo by Matthew Brady. Mm-hmm. You don't try to take out the legless soldier or
right.
the horrible wounds or the horrible depth of what he was capturing. That is what was happening, and it should remain present. Well, let's get down to the brass tacks. Give us the show times and ticket information.
Well, you act like I just have that memorized.
Yeah,
it looks like you're prepped.
I'm getting ready.
Yeah, he asked me beforehand.
Well, so we do Thursday through Saturday at 7:30, and then we have a matinee on Sundays at 2. Is that right?
Yes,
2 o'clock.
At 2 o'clock.
And this is at the Shreveport Little Theater, and you can call for tickets. You ready for this?
Yep.
424-4439.
And that is this week and next week.
That's right.
2 weeks, so Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and then Sunday at 2.
And you can also get the information on the website, which is ShreveportLittleTheater.com. Right. But it's a great show, and I hope people come out for it.
All right. So any final words you want to share for folks?
Oh, I just want to say this has been first off, thank you, Bill, for having us in again. It's been too long.
Yeah, you got to bring the centenary students.
I know. We've kind of fell off of that. But this is a great opportunity to get some word out to the community. I do think it's a show that the community will really respond to. Yeah. And it's been a joy to work on and a real collaborative process with this cast. So
it's been a great experience for me. The cast is awesome. And I'll say this, I was running lines at my parents' house the other day, and my dad was just like, "What is that? I like that." I'm like, Dad isn't usually too interested in what I'm doing, but he responded to this, and I think it's something that people from this part of the country can really feel and relate to.
All right. Blaine and Logan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
That was Blaine Weaver, who is featured as George in Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, along with Logan Sledge, who directs this production. This will be performed by the Shreveport Little Theater. It opens up tonight at 7:30 with multiple showtimes this week and next at 812 Margaret Place in Shreveport. For more information, you can visit them online at ShreveportLittleTheater.com or call the box office at 318-424-4439. That's 318-424-4439. For Red River Radio, this has been a Red River Radio Spotlight, and I'm Bill Beckett.